We are waiting just a few moments, and now here comes the introduction of the speakers by Don Cowan.
I'd like to welcome each of you to our first seminar session this morning, titled The Negro and the Ghetto. The moderator for the panel this morning is Dr. Richard Kramer. Dr. Kramer did his undergraduate work at the University of Michigan and got his PhD degree at Harvard. Dr. Kramer is now in the sociology department at the University of North Carolina with a specialty in racial relations. Dr. Kramer.
Thank you. Life for the vast majority of Negroes is life in the ghetto. And to understand and to solve the problems of Negroes in the United States, we must examine these problems in the context of his typical environment, the ghetto. For this environment is a central factor in the vicious circle creating and sustaining these problems. Today we're focusing on two questions. First of all, in what ways do education, family life, health, housing, and so forth in the ghetto work against the assimilation of the Negro into white culture? And secondly, what are the prospects for improvements in these conditions? Our first speaker this morning has sometimes been described by people who perhaps don't know him as a radical, rabble-rousing northerner from Boston, from Harvard. Well, this all sounds good, that he's somewhat radical, I guess. He's somewhat rabble-rousing. He is from Harvard. But there's a surprise when you hear his good Richmond, Virginia, Southern accent. I introduce to you now Professor Thomas Pettigrew of the Department of Social Relations, Harvard University.
Thank you. A piece of advice, though, I can give you is that never be introduced by an ex-student of yours, which is what just happened to me. Now, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning and speak here at the 1965 edition of the Workforce Symposium on Contemporary World Affairs, Challenge 65, and I certainly hope that it's going to continue in future years. When I visited Wake Forest during my undergraduate days at the University of Virginia, it was on the old campus. This is the first chance I have had to be on your new campus. And as I recall it now, we were always losing badly to Wake's fine athletic teams. Thus, I particularly welcome this chance to revisit your college, to see the new campus, and particularly welcome the occasion because I don't anticipate another athletic beating by 20 points. Now, to put the serious problem of our nation's ghettoization of the Negro in proper perspective, I think we need first to discuss the often made distinction between de jure and de facto segregation. I would say that the distinction is breaking down there to the point of where it is of little value in understanding the ghettoization of the Negro. For the first part, de jure segregation is ending in the South. It has not completely ended, but it is well on its way to ending here in Winston-Salem. It has a long ways to go yet in states like Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana. But we can see the end of de jure segregation in sight. But de facto segregation, on the other hand, where segregation is not backed by law, but is in fact there, is spreading throughout the nation, not just in the South, and it is becoming actually a more desperate problem. From 1940 to 1950, every major city in the United States increased in its ghettoization of the Negro. That is, that the percentage of non-whites, as judged by the census, who lived on blocks where white Americans lived, decreased in every city of the United States, north, south, and west, from 40 to 50. From 50 to 60, there was a variable pattern in the north and west. Some cities actually, the ghettoization process slowed or stopped or even turned slightly. But in the south, it has grown rapidly worse, from 50 to 60 and now in the 60s. to where the jury segregation may be ending, but ghettoization in the form of de facto segregation has actually increased in the South over this very same generation of rapid racial change. Thus, despite progress far beyond any other 25-year period in American history, in virtually all other realms, Negro Americans find themselves today more ghettoized throughout the nation in 1965 than they were in 1940. Second, there's a special stigma and special discrimination against the Negro American. People often go wrong, including Professor Hanlon, a professor of history at my Harvard University, by trying to make an analogy of the Negro with other groups, with Indians, with, in Hanlon's case, he wants to identify them with the immigrant groups that came into this country in the last part of the last century. These analogies all break down because of the very special and especially debilitating experience of the Negro American in the last 350 years in this continent. Slavery, a special kind of slavery, the most severe form of slavery the world ever devised, was the American form. And then segregation, and then poverty. And now the ghettoization through de facto segregation. For instance, Puerto Ricans in 1950 to 1960 in Chicago became more desegregated in terms of housing residents in those 10 years from 50 to 60 than the Negro American has ever been able to manage in Chicago from 1920 to 1960. The Puerto Rican with color, prejudice presumably operating against most members of the group, with language and cultural difficulties, the Negro American has never suffered from in this country, in spite of these, received so much less discrimination in Chicago, which is not a city famous for its hospitality to Puerto Ricans any more than other people's, nevertheless was able to disseminate residentially far more in 10 years than the Negro American has ever been able to do in 40 years. And Chicago is no special case. I just mention it because we have the best data for that city. Third, cities of the two regions are growing more similar then, as de facto segregation and the exportation of the segregation characterizes cities in both the North and South, and as the special de jure segregation form in the South actually begins to diminish. Now, what I'm talking about, of course, in the South is what I like to call the Northern plan. That is, you don't need segregation laws to maintain racial oppression in the South. All you have to do is follow the way the North has done it for many, many years. In the North, they don't get bad headlines. They don't have incredible laws against discrimination. They have laws against discrimination, but laws for discrimination, segregation laws. But in point of fact, they manage to segregate across the board nevertheless, by essentially making sure that housing remains as segregated as possible. And so far, the anti-discrimination laws in housing in northern states have been almost total failures for breaking into this pattern. As long as they have that, then they don't need other segregation laws, because de facto, most realms of life will be segregated. Now, the South is rapidly setting this up. Cities all over the South are consciously following the Northern plan. I always remember once in the Boston Library, of all places, I was giving a speech, and it's a very interesting place to give a speech because people can come tumbling off the street and sit down and listen if they want to. It makes a much more fascinating audience than usual. And one gentleman in the back of the room missed the point that I was being facetious when I went into a little argument to the effect that as a Southerner, I was ready to admit that the South had lagged behind the North in a lot of things, that the North had factories before we did, they had shoes, big cities, and so on. But I said, we catch on, we're not that dumb. And the South, I said, we have big cities now too, and we all wear shoes, and we even have some of your shoe factories, and We have factories now. We took them mostly from you. But we've caught on. We do all of that. And we're beginning to catch on about race relations, too. We're beginning that we don't have to have all those bad headlines and those terrible segregation laws. All we have to do is have the Northern plan, set up de facto residential segregation, and everything takes care of itself in the most racist form possible. And the gentleman in the back of the room took me cold seriously that I was advocating this for the South and came down the middle aisle until he had to be fortunately restrained. So now I'm very careful to mention it's facetious. Now, I mean this about the South, and what particularly irritates me, I must say, is that federal money is often spent in ghettoizing the southern cities, and this is part of the Northern plan, too, because northern cities have been spending federal money for years to increase ghettoization. The way it's done is very simple. It's called urban renewal, and you renew part of the slum area of largely inhabited by Negroes, and you make sure that their relocation will increase the ghettoization of the city. Northern cities have worked this out to a fine art, and now Southerners are planning along the very same lines in cities all the way from my native Richmond to Houston, Texas. Now, probably the city that deserves the all-time prize for attempts to exploit ghettoization in the South along the Northern Plain is Norfolk, Virginia. Virginians have often led the way in the South, you know, and particularly in the racial field. Senator Byrd has been one of the more innovative people. And I'd say Norfolk much the same way. Norfolk started building for its elementary schools little schools of 3 and 4 rooms. This way they could put them on practically every second block and then argue, particularly in the Negro district or in the fringe of the Negro district, and then argue in federal court for the neighborhood school principal. Because after all, every block had its own school almost. Finally, Negroes joking in the Freudian wit sense of joking, remarked that the city would soon provide a separate school for every Negro child in their backyard. Now, this is a pattern we will continue to see grow in the South, and it's one that if we expect the South to, in fact, overcome its racial difficulties, and for all Southerners, regardless of their race, to be treated as equals, then the de facto segregation there poses a problem in some ways more serious than de jure segregation ever posed as far as getting rid of it. Now finally, whether a ghetto is de jure or simply de facto, whether it is northern or southern, separate and inferior, separate facilities for Negroes still translates into poorer health, higher crime, less employment opportunities, lower incomes, lower IQ scores, and inferior schools. Of course, we're talking about the vicious circle that Myrdal first pointed out, where the ghetto is the key link in the vicious circle. For instance, in poorer health, Negro Americans at birth can look forward to 6 to 8 years shorter lifespan than white Americans. And this is traceable directly to preventable diseases, not to hereditary diseases that would make Mr. Kilpatrick happy or other races, to TB, to influenza, to diseases that are frequent in the ghetto because of inadequate medical care and because of the housing facilities or the lack of them for people who live in the ghetto. Higher crime, most of this higher crime in the ghetto is inflicted upon other members of the ghetto. Negro crime is often talked about as if all the victims were white. For instance, Negro homicide, over 90% of the victims of Negro homicide in every city in the United States that has adequate data on this, about 95% usually, are Negro victims. Negroes are the people who suffer from Negro American crime predominantly. Third, less employment opportunities, lower incomes, the lower IQ scores, and the lower IQ scores inevitably intertwine with inferior schools. Now, it is this last mentioned characteristic of Negro ghettos that I'd like to focus upon specifically this morning and in detail. For in microcosm, I believe that ghetto schools reflect the basic problems of the discriminated against ghetto in general. I think we may begin by asking, why are Negroes today so upset over racially segregated, or as the euphemism has grown in the North, unbalanced schools? Our answers to this query, I think, come from many directions. Some are historical. Negroes are the only Americans who've ever endured slavery, as I've indicated, and whose very skin color activates to this day a very special stigma associated with that experience, which other groups in the United States have not suffered from. Consequently, Negro Americans learn that, for them at least, racially balanced facilities are necessary if they are to receive anything resembling equal opportunity, that as long as it's separate, it was in fact never equal, even in a brick and mortar sense of equal. Some of the answers of why the Negro Americans today are so concerned about education, and particularly desegregated education, are political and legal, obviously. Even in brick and mortar terms, separate facilities for Negroes have never really been equal, as I just mentioned. An important fact, this is due in large part to the political realities which mitigate against predominantly Negro schools receiving truly comparable instruction facilities. The primarily Negro schools in the midst of the city's ghetto are typically older, more crowded, and allocate less money per pupil than the average school in the system. Put bluntly, balanced schools are needed to ensure the necessary political leverage. Many white school officials, North and South, reveal a strong interest in the education of Negroes only when Negroes are found in the same schools with sufficiently large numbers of whites. On de jure segregation, of course, the Supreme Court has ruled unequivocally. On de facto segregation, however, the law is still forming in the courts. A recent Illinois state statute prohibits unbalanced schools in the state of Illinois. And a recent decision of the highest court in California, state court, favored the creation of balanced schools in a case that did not involve prior acts of explicit discrimination by the school board. But on the district federal court level, we have an array now of decisions which run the full gamut, from decisions which are very similar to this California Supreme Court decision, as one we recently had in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the school board was not shown to be in good faith or to have ever purposely gerrymandered with the school districts, but nevertheless were commanded to make sure that every school in which Negroes were in Springfield was in fact a racially balanced school. Now there have been other cases, as in the case in Gary, Indiana, and a very recent case taken up by the Supreme Court of Kansas City, Missouri. I guess it was Kansas City, as a matter of fact. But both of those cases, in fact, supported the fact that school boards did not have to worry about balanced schools. Now, so far, the Supreme Court of the United States has refused to hear any of these cases, no matter which way they have gone. And so the law is still very much in the formative stage at the district court level. Though the press tends to interpret the last time that this last case from Kansas City, that when the Supreme Court refuses to hear a case, the press interprets this as meaning the Supreme Court favors the district court decision and supports it. Point of fact, they have not heard any of the cases, regardless of how they went. And so that assumption is unjustified until the Supreme Court, in fact, agrees to hear one of these cases. Now, further reasons for the Negro's concern around schools, of course, involves the American dilemma in its broadest dimensions, the American dream. The American dilemma, of course, is that we never have obtained that American dream. The Negro American is totally American. This we should never forget. Actually, we all know it, but it's so obvious that we don't think of it, and we don't think of its importance. I might also say no one is more Southern than Negro Southerners, but white Southerners have a way of not thinking of that and using the word Southerner just to apply to white Southerner, which I think is an abomination of the term. Now, Negro American then is totally American. His 14 generations here have completely immersed him in this culture. Almost two centuries of African colonization schemes for Negroes have failed to budge him. He's never taken any interest in this, any widespread interest at all. The Communist Party's tireless efforts to exploit his poverty and oppressed status have miserably failed. And even the present Negro Revolution aims to join rather than to destroy the society it confronts. This basically American orientation means most Negroes have internalized the American dream of equal opportunity, and they have decided that the highly valued institution of public education should be the critical focus of the effort to achieve that dream, at least for their children. Moreover, racially balanced schools are viewed by many Negroes as the only form of public education which can adequately fulfill the dream, for they are convinced that only integrated living begun in the earliest years can ever eradicate racial bigotry. Now, what's racial balance got to do with education? Well, apart from these historical, political, legal, and moral answers I've just briefly covered, there are, I think, a variety of social psychological answers to this blunt query. And I would like to just discuss briefly in closing some of these social psychological considerations of why balanced education, South, North, West, is essential not just for Negro Americans, but for all Americans, regardless of their race. I'd like to discuss it in terms of human learning, communication, creativity, personality dynamics. First, students need to be taught in environments similar to those in which they will later be required to perform. Now, this is a direct imperative of a basic principle of human learning. Psychology has probably got more research experimental support for than maybe any other single generalization in human learning. For those of you who've had psychology courses, you know this goes under the general rubric of transfer training. That is, the basic principle that alteration of salient environmental features associated with original learning results in diminished retention and performance. If you alter the situation where the person is expected to perform from that which he learned material in originally, then his performance will be somewhat deterred in almost direct proportion to how much you alter it. For instance, if you take an exam in a room different from the room you always met for the lectures in the course, and if the person giving you the exam, well, even if that much is true, if you take the exam in a different room, you get a somewhat lower score than if you were in the room where the original learning actually occurred. If you're in the same room, but the proctor for the exam is different from the instructor, there's a tendency for lower exam scores. If you're in a different room and have a different proctor, you get still lower, slightly exam. If you wondered where that C came from last semester. Now, this is one experiment among hundreds that psychologists have done in supporting this general principle I'm putting forward here. And you see, though, what follows for it and what is relevant for balanced education. That is, since Negroes must perform well in interracial work situations if they're to be occupationally upgraded in the future. And let's face it, that's what the Negro American Revolution is all about. It's what the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, 1964, is all about. This is to be, then it follows that they should be educated in schools that provide the interracial learning situations similar to the performance situations they will later be expected to perform in. Now, I might just point out that that principle is two-edged and covers white Americans as well as Negro Americans, that if white Americans are going to be expected to perform adequately and well in interracial situations in the future, they too should be educated in interracial situations. Thinking of what's wrong with Wake Forest still being a segregated school, the reason for it can be primarily selfish. It's that you're not being prepared in an all-white school for the world that you're going to have to perform in. Now, I know Wake Forest is now beginning its desegregation program, and I might say not a bit too late, but not a bit too late in any Southern school for this process to take shape. Now, there's a standards problem, and that was touched on last night, too. The standards problem, of course, is simply that the standards of Negro schools are typically allowed to be below that of white schools. They're allowed to be this way for many reasons, but usually for reasons of finances and for reasons of neglect. But in any case, whatever these reasons, the standards are so different that the Negro child who does as well as the school allows him to do and is making A's, when he shifts to an interracial situation, often finds he has to struggle to get B's and C's. The reason, obviously, is not the child, but the standards have changed for the child. Now, one reason why I think Negro Americans have been able to perform as well as they obviously have performed in athletics is that standards tend to be universal in athletics. If you run a 9.5 100-yard dash, that's a 9.5 good performance wherever it is run and by whoever runs it. Standards that universal are hard to keep up in segregated educational situations. This is one reason why separate facilities are impairing. Another reason why separate facilities are impairing. Third, there's a communications analogy with schizophrenic theory in clinical psychology, which I think highlights the importance of the role schools can play in countering the racist messages still lingering in the larger society. Schools obviously can't be blamed for all the problems of America. But we ask our schools, our public schools, we ask our public schools to try to correct a lot of problems for which they are not really directly responsible. We ask them to set up special education for all sorts of children, for retarded children, for gifted children, for all sorts of special cases, for which the school is not responsible, but we use this important institution in our culture to try to correct or help certain aspects that have been caused by other aspects of our society. Now, this is, I think, no different in the case of race relations. I think in this case, the school is countering not only what is taught explicitly in formal instruction, but implicit, that it can counter these racist messages, not only explicitly in formal instruction, which is the way I think we tend to think about it, but also implicitly by the biracial composition of its students, by the biracial composition of its teachers and its principals. Administrators. Now, on the one hand, what the schools have to counter, of course, is the Negro child finds himself in what is called in psychology a double bind. On one hand, he hears the work hard message. He's told that any American with talent and ambition who works hard can be successful. And anyone who is not successful must not have what it takes. Now, this message of work hard messages just pervades our mass media. And we're all subject to this belief. Now, on the other hand, the Negro child also hears the know your place message. Any Negro who openly strives to get ahead of white people is too uppity and obviously doesn't know his place. Now, this is similar to the situation of the potentially schizophrenic child whose mother tells him constantly that she loves him, but by what she does makes it very clear she does not love him. In other words, he's caught in a double bind of conflicting messages also. Now, it's found that many potentially schizophrenic children with such schizophrenogenic mothers, mothers who tend to produce with this kind of behavior, schizophrenic children, do not become schizophrenic. And this is one of the major findings, I think, in this area. In psychology, the main reason is they're able to get out of they leave the field. They get out of this binding home situation. They find other models than their parents. And often the public school, of course, is a very important source of such models. The athletic coach is often serving this for boys, for instance, and so forth. Now, to carry through the analogy, I think likewise Negro children need to leave the field. Need to leave the field of American society in this case, which is offering and communicating these conflicting messages. Need to find the type of consistent guidance and reassurance that only a racially balanced school can provide. In addition to frequently the balanced school and other educational controversies focus, I think, myopically upon IQ and achievement test scores. Did he make an 88 or an 87 or an 86? And we get so concerned over a couple of points, we lose sight of a lot of even more important issues involved in education, particularly consideration of higher mental processes such as creativity, which are correlated but only mildly so with IQ tests and such measures. Now, a brief review of the principal research findings on creativity reveals a series of personal characteristics which must be encouraged and developed if you are to encourage creativity in children. These characteristics are, and I quote them right from the creativity literature, openness to experience, recognition and acceptance of personal differences, desire for complexity, personal insight, and an independent unwillingness to submit totally to authority. Now, I say that each of these traits would be difficult for a segregated school to foster, since by its very structure, it is a societal symbol of the restriction of experience, of the rejection of individuals because of racial differences, of the desire for simplicity, the refusal to probe psychologically, and the total submission to authority. And from the perspective of personality dynamics, racially balanced schools include aspects which are both detrimental and facilitating to Negro performance. Now, these ideas are based on considerable experimental laboratory evidence now in social psychology, particularly evidence gathered by psychologist Erwin Katz at New York University. Now, field evidence, however, directly from the classroom is still scarce. We have one field study in New York City, another in a middle-sized New England city. Whenever you see that middle-sized New England city, it's always the same city. It's New Haven, Connecticut. In New Haven, so far this preliminary data in the field support the laboratory conclusions quite well. These investigations indicate that the facilitating effects easily outweigh the detrimental effects of biracial situations in effective balanced schools. The key word there is effective. You can turn a desegregated school into a nightmare, of course. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure how to do it. There are many ways, of course, delicate problems that are involved, particularly in the initial stages of desegregated or balanced school. But there are many facilitating aspects for both Negro children and white children that can be brought to bear in these schools with imaginative educators. Now, I should add, in honesty, that segregationist critics raise the additional issue of psychological comfort. Speaking confidently for Negroes as usual, these critics emphasize only the detrimental forces potentially operating in biracial situations, and they claim that Negroes are happier, healthier, and more comfortable in all Negro settings. Now, to be sure, there is evidence of tension among many Negro children and among white children, too, during the initial stages of integration. It would be strange if this were not so. But the critical question, it seems to me, arises as to what price comfort. If you allow me a terrible pun, I would like to believe that our public schools are a little bit more than just comfort stations. Now, to suggest that Negro personality problems are best handled by continuing the segregationist practices that are largely responsible for these problems strikes me as a curious idea at best. Lobotomized patients are often more comfortable too, but they are impaired for life. Now, finally, a temporary working definition, I think, has to be put forward of racial balance. Just what is racial balance that I'm talking about? Now, here I know the moderator disagrees with me, and maybe we can get a fight going a little later. But I believe that a number of social psychological considerations lead to a temporary and initial I think you need a definition for this transition stage. Hopefully, once we work our way through the transition stage, the subject of race, the category of race, will be irrelevant in American society, and we wouldn't have to use such artificial definitions. But until that time comes, I think a working definition of a balanced school is one which has approximately 20 to 45% of its student body Negro. Now, similar to the practical suggestions made by others concerned with this issue, I'd just like to mention briefly a few action recommendations that I think lead directly from these social psychological considerations. First, for a host of reasons, racially balanced education needs to begin in kindergarten and the first grade. Indeed, from the most recent evidence, we'd suggest preschool years, by the third or fourth year of life, as early as possible. For the damage is very cumulative. Second,